Some events are so important, so significant, that we all remember where we were and what we were doing when they took place. I'm talking about events like the September 11th attacks, or the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy, of Robert F. Kennedy, or Martin Luther King. But for Americans of my generation, we all remember where we were when we learned of the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger. All of the astronauts on board were killed. One of them was a public school teacher, the first American civilian in space. What could cause such a horrible disaster? Everybody in the country wanted to know. We finally learned the details, and it was thanks to a whistleblower. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. The Space Shuttle Challenger exploded on January 28, 1986, just 73 seconds into its flight, killing all seven crew members on board. The shuttle was 14 kilometers above the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Cape Canaveral, Florida, when it disintegrated. It was the first fatal accident involving an American spacecraft in flight. Almost immediately, investigators began to suspect that the culprit was something called an O-ring, which experienced a catastrophic failure in flight. An O-ring, very simply, is a rubber seal, both primary and backup, on the joints of a solid rocket booster. The O-rings prevent hot gases from escaping through the joints of the rocket's four segments. But that's what happened. In video that became famous almost immediately around the world, a flash of fire can be seen where an O-ring should have prevented that. And in a fraction of a second, the space shuttle was destroyed. As it turned out, many people inside the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, had been worried about the O-rings. Engineers at Morton Thiokol, the defense and space contractor that manufactured the O-rings, knew that something was wrong and that there was a good chance that they could fail. They were in the process of redesigning them and had intended to install new O-rings later in 1986. But as in most whistleblower cases, where the public has a right to know, the government keeps the information secret. Our next guest is the one who told us what the truth was surrounding the Challenger disaster. Richard Cook was a budget analyst at NASA from mid-1985 until early 1986. That's not a long period of time. What is important is that almost immediately after assuming his position, Richard warned his supervisors about the safety of the solid rocket booster used on the space shuttle. He wrote specifically about the O-rings, saying this, quote, "There is little question that flight safety has been and is still being compromised by the potential failure of the seals, and it is acknowledged that failure during flight would certainly be catastrophic," unquote. Richard Cook, we are so grateful to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Very glad to be here, John.
Richard, this is such a fascinating story and one that changed the course of the U.S. space program. I want to start from the beginning of your time at NASA. You were a young man, you were new to the job, but you had the background to see a problem right off the bat and the presence of mind, frankly, to warn your superiors. How did that happen? How was it that you were able to determine so quickly that there was a problem?
Well, let me just say, I wasn't that young. I was 39 years old, but I had been working for the federal government since 1970, really, so over 15 years. And I had quite a variety of assignments. I started with the U.S. Civil Service Commission, and then from there I worked at the Food and Drug Administration. And I had a pretty good career trajectory going. I went into the commissioner's office at the Food and Drug Administration, and I was trained as a technical writer. But very quickly, I began to work with scientists, doctors, people at a pretty high level. So I had a knack for talking to the experts and for understanding what was going on. And then I, very fortuitously, I got an assignment to the Jimmy Carter White House, where I was there working in the Office of Consumer Affairs on issues having to do with consumer economics. So I had quite a variety of experience, and I went out of the government for a couple years and then came back after I had spent some time working for a defense contractor, the TRW company, in a project that was going on out in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. So this was my introduction to high tech, as it were. And NASA picked me up. TRW offered me a job. But NASA picked me up, and I was immediately assigned to the space shuttle program in the comptroller's office. And I was supposed to be looking at space shuttle hardware from the standpoint of cost analysis, particularly because there were so many cost overruns going on. So I got a very rapid orientation to space shuttle hardware. Because in that office, you had to work with the engineers, you had to talk to people and find out what was going on. We visited all of the NASA field centers, including the Kennedy Space Center, where I was down there a week before the Challenger disaster. But I had the ability, I guess, to talk to engineers and understand what they were saying. And as soon as I began to work with the headquarters engineers who were in the solid rocket booster program, they began telling me of the potentially disastrous problems with the solid rocket boosters. And being an experienced analyst, I wrote it all down. I passed it up to my superiors with a whole series of memos that I was writing throughout the fall of 1985. And then I saw on the TV monitor at NASA headquarters the explosion of Challenger. And the speculation began immediately that day that it looked as though on the films that the solid rocket boosters were the cause of the disaster, that there had been an explosion. NASA, meanwhile, was putting out the story. They had no idea what was going on. The investigation could take months. It might never discover the exact cause. But I went back to my notes, to my documents, and to the engineers who had been giving me all this information. And everybody knew at NASA headquarters exactly what had happened. And days went on, and finally I got tired of trying to raise awareness of this through various channels. So I just said, well, heck with it. I'm going to take these papers to the newspapers. So I called the New York Times, and they said, yeah, this looks pretty interesting. Come on down. And that Sunday, the O-ring papers were published. So that's kind of how I got into it.
Another thing that you had the presence of mind to do was to consult NASA engineers. They, too, told you that they were worried about the O-rings. One engineer told you that he was so worried about the O-rings that every time the space shuttle lifted off, he would hold his breath. Why were these warnings discounted? Why were they ignored by the NASA bureaucracy? How could something like that happen?
Well, that's a long story. And I didn't really understand the whole story at that time. But I left NASA the week after I gave testimony to the Presidential Commission. They did call me to the stand, and I did try as best I could to explain the things I had written and to point out to them that NASA had known about this problem for many years. So subsequently, I began to collect documents. I published a couple of newspaper articles, including one in the Washington Post that got quite a pretty good readership. And it wasn't until I retired from the government in 2007 that I put all the information together to truly, really and truly try to understand what had happened. And the primary conclusion that I reached was that the space shuttle, and I could see this when I was there, the space shuttle was in the process of being absorbed into the Department of Defense. There was even speculation that at some point it was going to be shifted over wholesale to the Air Force. And what was driving that was what was known at the time as the Star Wars program. This was President Reagan's weapons in space program that he claimed was a defensive system. But in reality, there was a whole series of studies and experiments that were going to go on in order to use the space shuttle as a delivery platform for putting weapons into space. And the budget for the space shuttle was increasingly dependent upon reimbursements from the Department of Defense. And as somebody said to me at one point during my research, you don't tell the Department of Defense, sorry, we can't do this. We got to stop for a couple years and fix some few things. They couldn't do that. It was the whole, it was like a juggernaut. And it was hiding behind this facade that NASA was perfect. The space shuttle was all completely understood. Nothing would ever go wrong. All of that was lies. And the little people down in the system, I mean, I don't mean that disparagingly, but I mean, a GS-14, GS-15 engineer is pretty small potatoes when it comes to the entire drift of the federal government and the Department of Defense and the White House to do something. And so nobody had the ability to put a spoke in the wheels and say, no, this has to stop. The whole system was railroaded into acquiescence in what the real insiders knew was potentially catastrophic.
You argued in an op-ed in the Washington Post in early 1986 that NASA's culture was such that it contributed to the disaster. That's something I hear from whistleblowers all across the U.S. government, and especially in the intelligence community. Can you explain what you meant by that? What was it about NASA's culture that made it so difficult to report on a problem that was, in the end, deadly?
Well, yeah, you know the phrase gung-ho. I once put on a hat that I bought that when I was working at Treasury, and it said U.S. Treasury Department, and this guy came up and said, what are you, gung-ho? Everybody in this system, particularly when you get into the military and intelligence side of things, is expected to be gung-ho. And what that means is you are pervaded by an atmosphere of fear. Your whole career, your whole livelihood, your whole self-image all depends on whether or not you're going to salute when they run some crazy policy up the flagpole. And if you salute and you're going to make it in the system, if you don't salute, it's career suicide. And that's the way NASA was. It was the most gung-ho atmosphere I had ever seen. I had not seen this in some of my other assignments, including the Carter White House. I mean, you could say stuff there that disagreed with the policies, and they might even talk to you about it. But no, not at NASA.
Thank you, Richard. We're speaking with whistleblower Richard Cook about the events leading up to the destruction of the Space Shuttle Challenger in January 1986. And the story doesn't end there. Stay tuned. We're going to talk about Richard's federal whistleblowing.
In 1941, with the Nazis' help, Croatian ultranationalists, the Ustashas, proclaimed the independent state of Croatia. Shortly after seizing power, they built the Jasenovac concentration camp, a place associated with the worst atrocities committed in Yugoslavia during World War II. The Ustashas used the camp system to isolate and exterminate Serbs, Roma, Jews, and other non-Catholic minorities and political opponents of their fascist regime. Conditions in the Jasenovac camp were horrendous. The guards tortured, terrorized, and murdered prisoners.
They sent them in concentration camps. So most of them died. It was incredible genocide.
The failure of the Ukrainian counteroffensive. You know, it was a failure that arises out of a series of illusions on the Western Ukrainian side. Illusions about their own strength, illusions about the strength of their Russian opponents. Basically, that, you know, that Russia and Ukraine was a door that just had to be kicked in, and the whole structure would come tumbling down. And those illusions have been shattered.
За военных, которые погибают, но они достойны защищать нашу родину.
По нам начали стрелять украинские. Мне ногу ранили. Вот так вот аж. Да чуть-чуть остался шрам.
Фашисты первыми наступали на нашу землю. А мы защищали ее, терпели, погибали. Но они все равно идут прямо до победы.
Wars are a result of lies. If wars can be started by lies, peace can be started by truth.
The importance of WikiLeaks can never be overstated. That transparency is an extraordinary journalistic achievement.
They just succeeded in finding documents that existed and making them available to the world public. I mean, what could be more honorable than that?
By publishing information and sharing information with the public, he was exercising the right to free speech. He did so in the public interest.
I've watched the tsunami of lies and smear engulf him endlessly, vindictively, perfidiously, and I know why they smeared him.
Isn't it ironic that no one who instigated that illegal and immoral war has been brought to justice? But the great truth teller sits behind bars, waiting 175 years of virtual death sentence. Are we going to let that stand?
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Richard Cook about his experience blowing the whistle at the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, just before the failure of an O-ring destroyed the Space Shuttle Challenger. That was exactly what Richard warned his superiors would happen. Good to have you with us, Richard. Thanks for staying.
Good to be here. Thank you.
One more question about the Space Shuttle, Richard. In 1986, after the Challenger broke apart and NASA tried to keep its own fault in it at bay by providing misleading or even dishonest information to the media, you contacted the New York Times and let them print key documents that you had collected over time. Along with that, you also testified before the Rogers Commission, which was investigating the disaster, and you became instrumental in exposing the White House's cover-up regarding the explosion. You only worked at NASA for about 7 months, leaving in February of 1986, the month after the incident. But you still managed to be honest and to do the right thing. What was the fallout from doing that? What was the reaction from your colleagues at NASA, from your superiors, and even from the White House?
Well, as I said, I left NASA right after I testified before the Presidential Commission. But I continued to be involved in the aftermath. I gave interviews to the commission staff. I gave interviews to the NASA Office of Inspector General, where I discussed a whole lot of other issues having to do with the space shuttle, some of which made it into the commission's report, but many of which did not. And I was also doing press interviews. When I got to Treasury, they pulled me into a meeting with the Treasury Department headquarters. I had taken a job with one of the component agencies within Treasury, the Financial Management Service. Nobody's heard of them, but they process trillions of dollars of government payments every year, and that's a pretty big project that I was starting to work on. But I was labeled as a whistleblower. In fact, my new supervisor was quite angry at me, but he got a job somewhere else and left. So I was able to work and to do my job. But a point came where I actually gave a press conference where I said that it looked to me as though the White House was involved in the flawed launch decision. As I was told later, the White House contacted the Treasury Department and told them to fire me. And of course, that would have been a personal disaster. But the head of our agency, his name was Ernie Douglas, and he was an old, hard-bitten career Treasury guy. Ernie actually told the Treasury headquarters, no, I'm not going to fire this guy. He's done nothing illegal. And that was the stance that they took when the rubber hit the road with my whistleblowing. From that point on, I was always a suspicious character, but I was still a pretty good analyst. And I think there was a kind of a grudging respect for me that I had won down in the bureaucracy. And so I actually got along pretty well for the next 20 years, retired with distinction.
Richard, I have to say, and I hope I'm not embarrassing you, but you were something of a whistleblower Superman. You were only on the job at NASA for 6 months, and you became a major whistleblower. And then you left NASA and went to the U.S. Department of the Treasury. It was there that you exposed serious problems in the monetary system. So tell us what that means. What was it that you exposed?
Well, that was kind of an evolving process. I did a lot of different kinds of things at Treasury. I was an analyst. I was assigned to all kinds of different projects. But later on, I began to develop training courses on the history of the Treasury Department and on the U.S. monetary system. And what we ran into at that time was that there were two parts of the government that you never were supposed to criticize. One was the Defense Department. They had their own financial system. And of course, during that period, the Defense Department came up with so many trillions of dollars that were missing, and that's never been explained, but we weren't supposed to go there. Same with the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve was the Treasury fiscal agent. That means they handled all of the external funding relationships for Treasury, including the sale of Treasury bonds, T-bills, all that, and to manage the federal government debt. Well, as I began to study this more and more, I began to realize that the Federal Reserve was really not a federal government agency. The Federal Reserve was a banking conglomerate that was literally owned by the Wall Street banks. And as I began to investigate this further and got into the origin of the Federal Reserve system, I more and more began to see the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913 as almost an insurrection by the money trusts against the congressionally mandated prerogative of Congress and the federal executive branch to create and manage the monetary system of the U.S. And I began to realize it was this whole federal system that was a Federal Reserve system, with the banks being increasingly deregulated, that led to the catastrophes that we've seen over and over again over the decades with the monetary system, including this enormous financial collapse of 2008-2009. And so when I began studying this, I began to realize that the monetary authority of the United States had been taken away by Wall Street and the big banks, and that it had to be restored if we were to gain any kind of stability or sanity in our monetary system. And I still believe that, and I'm still writing about that.
You had a long, proud career of 32 years in federal service, and you made news more than once. You went to Treasury already having a reputation as a truth teller. Ronald Reagan was still president then. The people at the White House who had tried to cover up NASA's and their own involvement in the Challenger disaster were still around. So what were things like for you at Treasury? Was life easier, or did you have to constantly defend yourself because you were a NASA whistleblower?
It was a lot easier. And I have a great fondness and respect for the career civil service. And that really began when I joined the government in 1970 with the U.S. Civil Service Commission. The men and women that I worked with then were tremendous professionals with integrity, with competence, and it continued that way through most of my federal career, and it was that way at Treasury. I really liked it there. People treated me well. I moved up the career ladder. I had a lot of interesting projects, and had an honorable retirement when the time came in 2007. And then I continued to write articles and books afterwards with no repercussions. I have a tremendous respect for the federal workforce and still do. I had that way all through my Treasury career, and I just really loved it.
Richard, thanks so much for being with us. It was a pleasure. President Calvin Coolidge once said, "Doing the right thing never requires subterfuge. It's always simple and direct." Coolidge was famously a man of few words, but these words are quite clear. Sometimes issues are clear-cut. They're right or wrong. Doing the right thing is always, always best. Just look at Richard Cook. His truth was in service of the American people. It's as simple as that, and history will smile on him because of it. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.